Good morning, everyone. It's a nice crowd. I want to thank everybody for joining us this morning. I'm Dave Hafner, CEO of Leggett & Platt. It's always a pleasure to come to New York. We're here today to give you a brief update and to try and answer any questions that you might have. With me today is Matt Flanagan, sitting over at the far end of the room. Matt's our Chief Financial Officer. And also with me is Susan McCoy, our Director of Investor Relations. There's a handout at, I hope everybody's got one. If not, if you'll let us know. Okay, there's a handout which is a duplicate of the slides that we'll show during the webcast. And then also there are quite a few other smaller slides at the back which are just basically informational that will fill in some of the questions that you might have later. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly in order to provide adequate time for Q&A. And this, there is forward-looking statement slide here, and I think everybody understands the reason for that, so I won't read that. Total shareholder return is our key objective. We announced a few months ago that we were changing the strategic metric of the corporation to one of total shareholder return. This is how we are judging our success for the activities and performance of the company. We intend to be in the top one-third of the S&P 500 in that regard, providing 12 to 15% return, total shareholder returns on an annual basis. There are several levers that are utilized in developing that total shareholder return, obviously a change in revenue or an improvement in margin, and then of course the cash yield, the dividends, we'll talk a little bit more about that here later, and share repurchases, and then of course any change in the price earnings multiple. Also important to know that we have this year for the first time changed our executive and business unit operating incentives and have them linked directly to returns as opposed to only tied to EBITs of the respective businesses. I'll also comment very briefly on some of these photographs. These are new products that have bubbled up to the top and are a direct result of a major product development initiative that we put forth about 18 months ago. And I was telling Susan back in the hallway that these products are like little babies of different genus. They all have different gestation periods, but the ones you see here are ones that are we are marketing now, and we're enjoying very good margins and some increased market share as a result. That one on the left is a foldable box spring unit, which has the same functionality as a standard semi-flex box spring, but can be literally folded, so it can be moved into some tight spaces that a full and a queen size box spring couldn't be done before. The one on the right is a taller coil, which effectively allows our bedding customers to eliminate a certain amount of polyurethane foam. And steel is not the only product that's going through incredible inflationary cost increases, foam is too. So this particular product we're able to help our customers save in excess of $10 to $12 per unit in the elimination of some foam. Okay. We have moved to a role-based business unit management style. We've classified our business units into basically four classifications. Three of them are shown in this colorful pie chart. The GROW classification are those business units that we believe are advantaged, have some significant opportunity for continued market share gain in an industry that is or has the likelihood of growing at something greater than a GDP growth rate. We intend to significantly pursue that growth through acquisitions or greenfields, and we'll spend capital wherever it makes sense to do that for those particular business units. In the core classification, these are businesses that generate substantial amounts of cash for us. that are not substantial cash requirers, businesses that have good margins and have the ability to continue to maintain market share or gain market share. Fix, there's really only one part of our company that has that that particular classification as we speak, and that's our store fixtures unit. I'll talk a little bit about that here in a few minutes. We're actually ahead of our plan in fixing our store fixtures business. And then the fourth category is divest. And we do, it's not on this pie chart, but we do have a number of our businesses that are, we're in the process of divesting. These classifications or roles are based on the strategy that we see for each one of them and the return potential for each of those. As I mentioned, or as I inferred, the capital expenditures are skewed so that we'll spend more of our capital on those growth-oriented businesses and less on the core and virtually none on something that has to be fixed. As a part of that whole portfolio review, which we started about a year and a half ago, we decided that we did not do a good enough job in strategic planning. And so the consulting firm that we asked to come in and help us do the classification and deep dive analysis on all of our business units, we also engaged them in an independent project to assist us in developing a strategic planning process. And it is very much more formal than we had before. The word rigorous, I think some of our operators would say that's an understatement, but it's a very detailed and good thing. As a result of that, we're finding opportunities that we didn't even know about in some industries that we've played in for a long time. Also, each one of those business plans puts forth a 3-year plan on a rolling average. It's reviewed every year. And I need to make sure I clarify that last bullet point there where it says 3-year plan to achieve greater than or equal to 10% total business return per year. Well, we have a lot of businesses that generate a lot more than 10% per year. So it's not okay for someone to be doing 25% total business return and to slide to 10. But we do have some businesses that fail to meet chronically our weighted average cost of capital there, and those are the ones that have to get to that minimum threshold. Next slide. Obviously, we're narrowing our focus. We mentioned earlier a few months ago that we're divesting our aluminum segment and 6 other of our business units. And when we come to slide 9, I'll comment a little bit more on the timeliness of those. There's about $900 million worth of revenue that's associated with those businesses that are earmarked for sale. We have shrunk the store fixtures business unit to a more profitable core. About $100 million of that business did not have adequate margins and were tied up in arrangements with customers that we simply didn't feel comfortable with maintaining that business. And so we encouraged those customers to, or we helped them go find some other people to meet their expectations. Now, I will say that a bit of that business has come back, and yet it's come back at margins that that are acceptable to our shareholders. But we did encourage a good bit of business to go away because it simply wasn't profitable enough for us. We've also eliminated some excess production capacity, right-sized, if you want to use that overused term, moving a substantial amount of volume into some of the more efficient facilities and making sure that we had regional productive capacity to meet the national and international requirements of those customers. We're also eliminating poor performing plants. Some of those are actually in the non-divested operating units. So anytime you have 250 or 300 profit centers, not all of them are going to be hitting on all cylinders at all time. And those that are chronically performing below where we think they need to, we are eliminating those plants. We aim to finish the implementation of this first phase of our strategic plan before the end of the year. And I'm pleased to tell you that we're probably a little ahead of schedule as we speak. We expect, and in fact are experiencing, some higher returns on the base portfolio, those businesses that stay in the portfolio. One of the things that that we've done is to make sure that everybody's bonus is tied to the return for their respective business unit. So, like I said, in the past, it's been primarily an EBIT-driven or an income statement-oriented bonus, and now we have a substantial amount of that bonus which is tied to the balance sheet or the capital employed for each of those businesses. Several other initiatives. I mentioned briefly product development. I guess I missed some pictures back there, but at the bottom of this page, you'll see a new chair control. It doesn't look very sexy there. It looks a lot better when you put it under the seat of the chair. Our office and contract business, I think most of you know, we're the largest producer of components for the office industry. And some of the products that the men and women are developing in that part of our company are just extraordinary. So product development is a major initiative, putting a lot of effort and a substantial amount of intellectual and capital behind that. We are finding ourselves being much more pricing disciplined than we have in the past. And that is not to say that we had no discipline. It's really rather to say that we're looking at what the alternatives are in each one of the industries that we participate in, the type of leverage that we provide, and trying to develop pricing disciplines that are more defensible than we've had in the past. We obviously continue to look at cost reductions. This is sort of my mantra, my background in engineering and operations, and we continue to keep a high priority on lean manufacturing and continuous improvement cost reduction. As I said, we've continued to consolidate. We're effectively through with that. And we also have contracted our overheads, not just at a business unit level, but at a corporate level. If you're going to be a smaller company as a result of divestiture or pruning unprofitable business, then it only makes sense to reduce your overheads. Okay. We're sending more cash to the shareholders. That's already commenced. We have always generated a substantial amount of free cash through some concentrated efforts. Last year, we generated $614 million worth of cash from operations, $614 million. Now, that is not a level that can be sustained, but a lot of that came through extraordinarily good working capital management, and we found that we can live on less, if you will, and that's a very good thing when you take a look at your free cash flow returns. As we generate this cash, we expect to have and are experiencing higher business unit returns, we will also simultaneously spend less on acquisitions, at least for some period of time here, and also be stingier with regard to our capital expenditures. You stack it all up, that means we have more to give back to the shareholders. A few months ago, we increased our dividend from 72 cents a share per year to $1 per share per year, which at the current EPS makes for a large payout ratio, but longer term we expect that payout ratio to be between 50 and 60% of our earnings. We're very comfortable with doing that based upon what we know we will generate from a cash flow perspective. Just the dividend increase, which that bullet point there says requires an additional approximate $50 million. Now that will come down as we contract the share base, but that'll be more than offset by reduction in CapEx and acquisitions. We will maintain priority on our stock repurchases. I think most of you know that we have a $10 million per share per year standing authorization from our board. We've repurchased 5 million shares so far this on that authorization. We actually purchased about 1 million of that in the fourth quarter of last year. We purchased a little over 3 million shares in the first quarter. And here in the second quarter, we've purchased approximately 1 million shares. We also have an additional 20 million share authorization for 2008. And we wanted to go ahead and get that authorization because we wanted to have the authority to go ahead and utilize the proceeds from these divestitures when those proceeds came home and or came back to Leggett. And we did not want to have a special meeting. Again, I'm going to talk about where we are in the divestitures right now, in fact. We had hoped, or I had hoped, that we might be here today to make an announcement. And timing is what it is, and I don't have an announcement today, but things are gaining momentum. And it would be likely, we hope, that towards the very end of this quarter, which is just a few weeks from now, or the very early portion of the third quarter, we will need to get back to you and the rest of our listeners and talk to you about some of these activities. Again, we should complete all of the divestitures here in 2008. We intend to use the proceeds to repurchase the stock. We've mentioned that. We're also making progress on that store fixtures improvement that we mentioned earlier. The segment president, the group president, and the unit president, along with their support staff, have it as their number one priority. We meet every 2 weeks to get a progress report on where they are relative to improving their profitability. And as I said, we're actually a little ahead of the PERT chart that was established, or the Gantt chart that was established for making sure we met that requirement. So we should be at the weighted average cost of capital before the end of the year. And obviously that's not adequate long term. We know that business will generate substantially more than that in the longer term. Our strategy planning process is in place. That's the rigorous strategic planning that I mentioned before. Our executive bonus is tied to that TSR at a senior executive level. So a substantial amount of mine and Matt's and other senior officers' bonus is tied directly to total shareholder return. Seemed only fitting, if that was going to be our target for the corporation, that our bonus should be shifted and tied to the benefit of all shareholders. I also might say that for many of us who have acquired a lot of stock throughout the years, it's really the stock price that drives us anyway. In the second phase of this change of plan, we intend to get back into a growth mode, but not at a 10 or a 15% CAGR necessarily. That's a very vicious, never-ending CAGR. We do expect to, to grow at something greater than GDP, maybe 4 to 5%, as we say in that second bullet point. Maybe more. Depends upon a number of things. But would rather lower the expectation to something that is more likely to be met or exceeded. And so that's the reason we have changed that goal. We will seek growth, but we won't do that at the expense of TSR. Hey, Susan, before I forget it, can you back up? I do want to show that one, this one adjustable, this is a four-way automatic adjustable massage unit for your car. And it's just an example. Sorry that I've been missing some of these opportunities to talk about new products, but it's an example of a combination of initiatives through our Shukra and Pulmaflex business. It's all patented, and so we have good intellectual property and good margins, even though the automotive business here in North America is weak. Automotive business in Europe is very much better, and the automotive business in Asia is very, very much better. And interestingly enough, some of these more sophisticated units are going into the vehicles that are being produced in Asia, also here in the United States and Canada, but in Asia. Thank you. At the bottom of this page, I wanted to mention that photograph on the left is a docking station, which is produced by a relatively new acquisition by the name of Gamber Johnson in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And that type of product, that's just one SKU, new product of theirs, but that type of product goes into commercial vehicles, police, law enforcement vehicles, delivery trucks, UPS, those sorts of things. And it's effectively the means by which you put your portable computer or other electronic device in your vehicle. And it's a very, very good fit with our commercial vehicle products group. And then on the right, our wire people love this picture because it's a, most of us, I don't know much about this product because it's a dishwasher. But my wife tells me that it's very important to have the right sort of racking in the dishwasher, and it uses a lot of wire, and you're laughing. It's telling you the truth. It uses a lot of wire, and was an excellent acquisition that we made also last year. Okay. As I mentioned early on, the targets for TSR are to be in that 12 to 15% per year. If it gets better than that, that's fine. But these are certainly that's the range that we expect. We expect that it'll be contributed in a balanced way from those four sources. Those that are listening are, that's revenue growth, margin improvement, dividends, and share repurchase. And we also expect by the year 2010, if not a little before, to have our corporate average EBIT margins back up to approximately 11%. I think I did mention earlier that longer term, our dividend payout ratio, we want to keep in that 50 to 60% range. And Matt will step up here momentarily and he'll talk to you more financially, but we will plan to keep our net debt to cap ratio in that 30 to 40% range, which is a reflection of our conservative nature. And the last slide I'm going to comment on real quickly, I'll let you read the bullet points. I won't go through each one of them, but there are certain things that are changing and they are big changes for a company like ours. But there are other, and those are the things on the left. We've talked about all of them here in my comments. On the other hand, there are certain things that will not change. The integrity, our candidness, our openness, our commitment to do a better job than we've done in the past. Product innovation is actually changing, but it's getting more important than it has been in the past. Our relationships really, really matter to us. We'll continue to generate a lot of cash. We revere our dividend growth record, and we intend to perpetuate that growth record. We'll keep that strong balance sheet, and obviously your inside management are committed to owning a substantial amount of the stock. And I just want to end my comments on a personal note. I'm not sure whether Harry or Felix are listening right now, but I want to pay tribute to two of my dearest friends, corporate friends and personal friends, Harry Cornell and Felix Wright, who recently retired from our board of directors. And these two gentlemen actually have been steering this company for 50 years. I've only been around half of that time. I've only been around a quarter of a century at Leggett. These two guys have combined put in 107 man years to help drive this company to where it is. And I can tell you they've both told me that their expectations are this company will be even better as we go forward. So Harry and Felix, if you're listening, I want to tell you again how much I appreciate your support. With that, I'm going to ask Matt to come up.
Thanks, Dave. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for being here and listening in on the webcast. And I'll be very brief because we want to get to Q&A. If you look on slide 14, that's simply a recap of our first quarter results. You see our organic sales were down 6%. A lot of our markets, no surprise here, were relatively soft as we came into 2008. Anything fairly residential flavored, as you might imagine, has got some headwinds going on right now. As Dave referenced, some of those sales we're glad they didn't show up again this quarter as part of the pruning process to eliminate some unprofitable business, and certainly part of the sales being a bit lower in the first quarter reflected that strategic initiative. First quarter EPS of 23 cents. Main headline really for the quarter for a lot of companies, not just Leggett, is raw material inflation and what is up with that. For us, steel in particular is a key raw material that we use, and it's certainly an article in the Journal Today, I think, that talks about what's going on there. So that was a real headliner. Certainly part of our EPS in the first quarter was affected by the fact we hadn't yet gotten out with some of our recovery efforts in that regard, but that has certainly been happening as we've gotten into the second quarter, as you see there in the second to the last bullet point. Those price increases are in place, many of them, and others, unfortunately, but need to be and are on the way. We repurchased, as Dave mentioned, a little over 3 million shares the first quarter. Average cost to buy those was $17.28. And I have three other quick tidbits for the first quarter that aren't on this page. The first one we're not really proud of, and that is the fact that we used about $45 million of cash to fund working capital in the first quarter. And Dave mentioned last year we had about $180 million of cash from working capital initiatives that came home to roost in 2007. What happened the first quarter, first of all, largely seasonally, that tends to be time of the year when we use some of our working capital. Secondly, because our operating folks did anticipate the run-up in some of the raw materials, did make some inventory purchases that we're glad they did, now that you see what's happened in some of those costs. And then we had our receivables stretch out a bit on us, and that is not all that atypical when you see times get really tough, and we're certainly on top of it, and initiatives on all of the pieces of working capital, inventory, AR, and AP, that gives us a lot of comfort to continue to stand here and say, for all of 2008, we expect our working capital investment to net go down and to provide cash when the year's grade card finally comes home to be shown. So anyway, we duly note that the first quarter we used $45 million of cash, and we will be turning that around for the full year. The second other bullet point that's not on here that I just wanted to mention is that our net debt to cap at the end of the quarter at 30.5%, which is the very low end of our 30 to 40% range. Many of you who followed us for a while have heard us talk about being in that range for a long time. Well, somewhat ironically, this is the first time we've actually crawled into that range in the last several years. And we certainly don't have any intent to dramatically leverage the company, as you know, but that's certainly a good cost of capital efficient place to be. And we're glad we're hovering in that zone now. And lastly, the third point that's not on here, I just reiterate, we paid 25-cent dividend in the quarter. We raised it compared to last year's first quarter, that's 47%. And now 2008, as we run it out, will be the 37th, mind you, consecutive year that Leggett will have increased its dividend. And that's something we're very proud of, and it has grown on average over that period of time 14%. So that's something we continue to passionately feel good about, and recognize fully that those dividends don't happen unless you're truly generating cash to help fund that return of capital to shareholders. By the way, today, or what yesterday where the stock closed, that's a 6% yield, a dollar dividend, obviously. So my last slide, slide 15, our guidance was issued on April 16th. Susan duly notes there's been no update since then. You see the dollar to the dollar 30 includes some restructuring, about a nickel for the whole year. I'll remind you that this EPS guidance for the full year does not anticipate gains or losses from our divestiture activity. Again, we're selling 7 business units. We will have likely both some gains and some losses, but the guidance right now doesn't anticipate that. And secondly, Dave mentioned the 10 million share authorization that we have and the incremental 20 million share authorization that the board recently approved. The 10 million, we assume in our guidance right here of $1 to $1.30 that we use all of that during the year. But the supplemental 20 million share authorization, and again, what dips into that in a big way, we hope will be the use of divestiture proceeds. That is not implied in this guidance. Sales of $4.2 billion for 2008, that would be basically flat with 2007. Operating cash flow, belly of our range implies something around $400 million of operating cash. If you add dividends, capital expenditures, that's about $300 million that we'll spend this year. So 400 less 300 leaves you somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million of cash left over after those two uses. And again, the share repurchase activity should be significant this year because of the divestiture activity that we have underway. We do feel that about $400 million after tax implications is what we collectively would like to bring home and hope to do better than that. But that's what you've consistently heard us talk about. And I will end my comments by simply saying, in the midst of what is certainly a tough economic environment, we're optimistic about the things we can control this year to drive shareholder value. Operating initiatives, certainly the divestiture activity, keeping our positions relative to leverage and the balance sheet, cash flow, all where they need to be. And that gives us a glass half full view of 2008, even as difficult as clearly some of the economic statistics we all read about every day. So with that, I'll turn it back to Dave, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, stay up with me, Matt. We'll try to answer. We'll double team any questions that we might get.
Alan?
Hi. If we were to go to slide 19, which I guess is in the supplement, and I just look at the different places that, you know, your mix of business. And it looks like the biggest, besides the bedding components, right next to it is fabric, foam, and fiber. Could you maybe tell us, when you've made your review, why you think that 17%, which is, let's say, $500 or $600 million, doesn't strike me as being that exciting of a place for Leggett to be, even though you've had some history there? And what are the characteristics of that, and why is it a keeper?
Yeah, Alan, let me start by saying that a part of that is on the divestiture list. Our fiber operations are going to be divested. And Susan, do you recall what the dollar amount?
No, in this particular chart, we've taken the divestitures out of it.
Oh, I apologize.
There's about somewhere between 80 and 100 million of revenue related to that.
That's correct.
Business.
This 17% is with that out. The what that does include is a carpet underlay, as an example, is a substantial profit generator for us. We have a very, I'll say, commanding market share in that industry. It certainly is correlated to things like housing starts and refurbishments and commercial construction and what have you, but it has very good margins for us. The Hanes Industries is a part of that. That is the non-woven products that would go into bedding and furniture and automotive and geotextiles. Those sorts of things. Again, we have a very large position in that, Alan. It's a complementary business for our bedding and furniture. And again, the returns are more than adequate on the assets that we have employed there.
So that 17%, excuse me, so that 17% of the business that you're keeping as this is performing, if the margins, as you talked about, the
yes.
target, those are businesses that are, because you have three different categories, you know, the fix, repair, replace, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, where do those...
Those returns are north of where they need to be. They are in our core business. Yeah.
Those aren't growing, those are core?
Well, there is a piece of it that is growing. I mean, we can talk about geo products.
Carpet underlay.
Both of those are advantaged businesses that we have that we expect to grow appreciably more than GDP type growth. And the returns are substantially north of where they would need to be.
The dividend is a dollar. The earnings, call it $1.15 this year. You have a targeted payout of 50% to 60%. Implies that dividend growth is going to have to be lower than earnings growth for a number of years. How are you going to manage that? Are we looking at maybe single-digit dividend growth or some fraction of earnings growth? It doesn't appear that you're going to just keep the dividend flat until earnings grow your way out of it. But what is the trajectory likely to be?
Well, it's reasonable to assume a single-digit dividend growth. Whether it's 4 or 5 or 7 or some percent like that, you can't expect, or we will not expect to see our dividend grow at the same rate as some of the improvement in EPS. So,
and until this recent major synchronized increase in the dividend corresponding directly to the strategic framework we're now operating under, we had been growing in the mid-single-digit percentage for many years, as a lot of you who have been longtime shareholders know, which has basically been about 4 cents a year, a penny move during the year at some point in time. And will we go back to that? We don't know. But for sure, we're dedicated to continuing to increase the dividend. But yes, I would not assume it would be at a double-digit rate in 2009, for example. And clearly, to get to a 50% to 60% payout ratio, if you're paying a dollar already, you need to get your earnings north of $2, you know, in pretty short order to have that math coincide with our guidelines.
And the analytic, we've basically taken our growth expectation, our revised growth expectation, our revised margin expectation, and the progression towards that, discounted it for tax requirements, and we've modeled that dividend based upon standard 10 million share per year for dividend purposes to get to that 50 to 55, 60% in the outlined 2 or 3 years.
And there's no question.
It's a 2 or 3 year period to get to that balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and there's no question that taking our EBIT margin, which roughly with our guidance this year is in that 8% sort of range, and getting it to 10 and then 11 is a key part of the affordability of that dividend at a 50 to 60% metric in the next 24 months. And we're dedicated to making that happen and confident that we can.
Yeah. Bud.
Yeah, David, I'm trying to think about what has changed and what is the same since you gave your original strategic plan, and then also since you reaffirmed or gave guidance at the end of the first quarter, and things like inflation and market dynamics obviously come to mind. Maybe if you could review for us through the corporation what's changed, what's the same, and how you've coped with those items over the past couple of months.
Okay. Well, certainly inflation has been a larger factor than we anticipated a few months ago. Thankfully, we're in a position where the cost run-up of raw materials has been so significant. It's reminds you of 2004, but even worse, if you will. Those cost increases have been so significant that they're relatively easier to pass along than if they were just marginal upward pressures of 1% or 2%. Everybody understands that no one in the supply chain can accommodate that. And so we have implemented those price changes with our customers and our customers with their customers. And that is different than we had originally anticipated. However, we have been able to maintain our margins for the most part in all of those price changes.
And market dynamics and also the credit markets are significantly different than, and so that reflects what investors believe you can get for your divestitures.
Well, that is correct. Matt, you might want to comment first, or I can.
Actually, Bud, and I think you've heard us talk about this, relative to the size, other than the aluminum divestiture, which is about $500 million in revenue, as you all know, it's the big one, but there are a lot of assets there associated with that business that even in this lending environment, there's a good level of leverage as a financial player might want to go in and drive those returns on equity with leverage as an assist, that window has not closed. And on the smaller divestitures, the other six, which are all less than $100 million in revenue, but are valuable assets, and again, there are assets there to be leveraged, we've seen that appetite is, I wouldn't call it robust, but it's certainly healthy. And we continue to believe, as we stand here today, and that has not changed our view of being able to divest those businesses and generate the proceeds that we thought, even though the credit markets have gone sideways.
Based upon the term sheets that we've reviewed from the banks, it appears that debt will not be a problem for these. But there's one other thing that I want to mention, and that is that even in a relatively tough environment that we've seen the last few months, we're gaining market share in a couple of key parts of our company. And I know we've mentioned this before, but one of the maker users, regional maker user for bedding products, they made their own inner springs, made the decision to bring that volume to Leggett and Platt. In the case of the imported Chinese units, as you know, we've got an anti-dumping. Is that your BlackBerry?
It's easier than mine, or Susan's.
Okay. Well, we've got an anti-dumping case that's being supported by our government at this point, and so we've seen a substantial reduction in the number of imports coming into the United States, and those have come back to us. And then, in the case of Berkline, which was publicly announced, there's a maker user of reclining chair mechanisms that saw fit to bring their business our way. So one of the things that is encouraging that is that even in a tough environment, we're seeing some pretty significant market share gains. So I apologize. I think you were going to say something.
The last part of the changes, it seems to me to be the credit quality of your customer base in these challenging markets. Have you seen much deterioration in that, and how are you coping with that?
Well, we watch that like a hawk, as you might imagine, Bud. And we've certainly been in a lot of these businesses a long time to know where the stress points start to show up. So, yeah, we would quickly say that, you know, some of our customer base has found it more challenging now than they did 6 months ago. But from a quality of the receivables base, and certainly our comfort with our reserve position, everything else is in keeping with past conservative practice. And we don't have any great fears in that regard. The last thing I'd mention, back to your overall question, well, what's kind of different now compared to 6 months ago when you all announced your strategic plan? And I would just say that within the company, there's so much that has already been ingrained and indoctrinated under this plan, and with this plan, everyone carrying this ball now, which is different. I mean, it just needed a bit of time to pass before everybody kind of was able to digest it, feel good about the bonus programs they have now in place that they didn't have in 2007, the strategic planning initiatives, the, well, what are you asking me to do now if I'm in this grow bucket versus this core bucket? All of that is really gaining good momentum with Dave and Carl leading that charge. So that's good.
Eric has a question over here.
Just an update on, you guys mentioned being more disciplined around price and your pricing strategy. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about, with these rising costs, when you implement these price increases, what you're seeing from your customer base, and obviously that eventually gets to the end consumer, which is, you know, seeing some challenges. So, you know, what is the relationship? I mean, is the pricing strategy an infinite? I mean, you can take 30% of price and things just keep going as normal. I mean, what is the equation to that end market on price increases, that or the way you think about it?
Yeah, it's never easy to go to any customer and talk to them about a price increase. So while the significance and the universality of this raw material increase makes it more understanding, if you will, it's never easy to go. Now, I think you realize that our component or sub-assemblies make up only a percentage of our customers' final assembly. So if we have a if we have say a 10% price increase, it may only require a 2 or 3% price increase by our customer. But when you add those on and they continue to aggregate, you know, again, no economist, but demand destruction is something that ultimately happens. And one of the things that we do to assist in offsetting that is value engineering or value assessment with our customers to see if there's any way, even though we might have a cost increase in our element or subassembly that we provide them, is there anything else that we can assist them in helping drive the total cost of their unit down? And our customers are very open to those sorts of opportunities and suggestions.
I guess just as a follow-up, you know, when you read through the filings, to your point about taking these price increases, is the trend that you guys have talked about in the past on decontenting, is that something that accelerates in this environment? Or is it, you know, it's so tough to switch in the middle of, you know, a challenging environment that people don't want to take the risk? I mean, how do you think about offsetting that, I guess?
Right. Well, there are a couple of times during the year in say, bedding or furniture where there can be significant changes, and it has to be before that product is established and set and then marketed. In general, yes, tough economic times, periods of high cost inflation of raw materials leads to more decontenting. However, we've had a substantial amount of decontenting for a couple of years or more now, and you can only do that so much before you start to affect the yield or the functionality of the unit. So it's really important to understand finite element analysis and computerized articulation and yield curves and things like that that we work with our customers to make sure that we can help them get their costs down and simultaneously maintain the functionality that they will need. Ultimately, our customers have to increase their price, and ultimately the consumer pays more in an environment like this.
Brad's next over here.
Yes.
Last November, when you laid out your strategic plan, one of the things you pointed to was roughly 100 basis points in margin improvement from productivity improvements, including purchasing. Just wondering if you could update us on that or any changes in thinking there. And then also on your 11% EBIT margin target overall, how conservative or aggressive would you say that target is?
Okay, and there's a chart, it's chart 35, which is I guess the antithesis of a waterfall chart, which takes us from our 2007 EBIT. This is an EBIT margin chart. And the light lavender colored 100 basis point piece is what you were referring to first. And some of the bullet points we have underneath there are product development, efficiency, procurement, as you mentioned, and pricing. And that portion of this gradient chart, I'm very comfortable with. In fact, I'm comfortable with this chart in total. This is what we expect to accomplish by 2010, if not a bit before that. Relative to how conservative or how aggressive, we think it's very likely that we'll be able to meet this EBIT target with a stable economy. We're not planning for things to get a lot better. If things get better quicker, then we will reach this or exceed this more quickly. If, God forbid, but if business got appreciably worse, very appreciably worse, then this would be more challenging to reach. At this point, it appears this is reasonable, and we may be able to reach that level a little before 2010.
And as a frame of reference on slide 41 and 42, as you get a chance to flip through here, you'll see that there was a time not all that long ago where the EBIT margins for the company were above 13%. Different mix of businesses back then, but part of what this strategic initiative announced in November is doing is getting us back to some of those businesses that are more advantaged and ought to naturally have EBIT margins certainly north of where we have been trending for the last few years.
And eliminating those that are chronically below that average, of course, mathematically helps buoy it.
Russell's next.
Just to go back to the health of your end markets, you've obviously done, sounds like you're doing a phenomenal job offsetting end market declines with market share gains. Is there a point, just given you have such high share already, where you see that equation no longer plays out, that, you know, there's no more market share to gain, or there's no way to continue to offset, you know, end market weakness in mattress sales or whatever else it might be?
Yeah, theoretically there would be a point. However, if we take a look at you know, bedding and furniture as two great big pieces of the company, there's still a substantial amount of maker user volume to be had, and it isn't necessary to take a maker user completely out of producing their own total series of SKUs. It could be that the development of a new product or a family of new products becomes so compelling that a maker user decides just to buy more than they currently buy from Leggett & Platt. So yes, in theory, eventually there would be a limit to it, although there's still a lot of running room both in bedding and furniture. Another thing I might mention is that we're doing more private label business for some of our customers. And the office furniture is a really good example. The Ames chair's in here, and the Herman Miller seating, gang seating's in here. Herman Miller are great. They're a great customer. They're a wonderful group of engineers and marketers, and they're virtual manufacturers, if you will. And they have come to Leggett & Platt and said, why don't you do this whole assembly to our specifications? Be careful, mind you, because you're playing with our brand, so be really quality conscious. And in doing that, we gain revenue, we gain value added, we gain incremental contribution margin, and there's a substantial amount of that business to be had, which we really have not participated in much in the past.
Yeah, and I just add simply and quickly that about 2 years ago, Dave particularly cranked up the product development and innovation. And now we're 2 years later, and it's a natural time, even as difficult as some of the markets are, to start seeming some of those seeds, and you saw some pictures of them, that were planted then and had been fertilized, now starting to come back to roost. And it also goes to the EBIT margin question, that as we get into 2009, 2010, a lot of that spade work, even before the strategic plan got announced in November, is now needing to come home, and it is coming home to bear fruit.
Where?
Two questions from Matt. The first one is, of your CapEx guidance, how much of that is what you would consider to be maintenance CapEx?
About $90 million.
Yeah. Okay. And then what sort of assumptions regarding the housing market underpin your guidance? And then for Dave, the question is, of these new products that you're talking about, to what extent will they move the needle in the near term? And to what extent should we focus on them as being part of the Leggett story?
Okay. Well, relative to the housing market, we are not anticipating any significant improvement in the housing market for the next several quarters. It'll be wonderful when it happens because some of our businesses are very highly correlated to the housing industry, like carpet underlay. That one's very tightly correlated, even though there's a lot of refurbishment And whenever you have a flood, you have to put new carpet in. But a new house, before someone moves into it, that carpet underlay is there, and so there's a tight correlation. We're not anticipating any significant or major improvement in the housing market in the next few quarters. We hope that's ultra-conservative. If it improves in a couple of quarters, that'd be wonderful for us.
We're assuming that we've hit
a low point and the point of inflection is not behind us yet. Now, with regard to the new products, and I think you know me well, and if I could just talk for hours on this subject, there's so many exciting new things and we don't have time to talk about them, like e-coupled. I wish we had time to talk about that. They are enough to move the needle. An example would be this VertiCoil product that is the new bedding product. That VertiCoil in heights that were unattainable in the past are allowing us to compete very effectively with the universal standard of the Bonnell coil. And there's no reason to believe that the VertiCoil or the family of VertiCoil products, which utilizes wire in a more efficient way, won't effectively eliminate or substantially replace the Bonnell business. It's a better value for our customer, and it's a better margined product for us. And that's just one example. So, yes, it's enough to move the needle. And it's one of the reasons, back to your question, it's one of the reasons we put it underneath that lavender piece of the EBIT gradient chart. They're very significant. And one other nice thing about these new developments, if you patent them, and generally we do, then you have protection, at least for some period of time, and generally higher margins. Of course, you invest more up front to develop them, but yeah, they're significant. The contribution margins are much better on these new products. Yes. Susan, right here. Okay, we'll get him next.
Thank you. If you look at the stresses on the consumer generally from food and energy prices, yeah, now, more and more employers asking them to pay more for their health insurance, yeah, the perennial need of state and local governments for more tax revenue from higher property taxes, sales taxes, the possibility that the next administration will raise taxes on the middle classes as well as the wealthy. Do you see any risk that the consumer-related demand for your products might be secularly and permanently lower as opposed to just cyclically lower?
Well, I think we're already experiencing that. Feel comfortable that the increased cost for all those things, the ability to consume some of the durable goods that our customers produce has gone down. And so we're already experiencing that. Relative to permanency, I don't think so. I believe that we'll see an upturn. Most of the products that we ultimately produce are products that have to be replaced, need to be replaced periodically, and so I don't think there's an evaporation, if you will, of demand that's never going to come back. But for sure, we're experiencing it right now. Alice Walton used to be on our board of directors, and I remember Alice telling me one time that they could predict pretty accurately what certain of their products were going to do based upon the cost of gasoline. Because the average consumer is, you know, they have to drive from their home to their work, and as that cost of gasoline, which is a, you know, kind of a universal staple, goes up, then they pretty well knew which other of their products were going to go down in demand. So we're already being affected, no doubt about that. On the other hand, I don't think that it's going to cause us to eventually have to abandon certain products because of a permanent lack of demand. That's my read on. I'm an engineer, not an economist. Yes.
Part of the increase in inventory, you said, is a decision on your part to pre-buy in a rising price environment. I'm just wondering if you're seeing a similar pre-buy from some of your customers for your products.
That's a really good question. In fact, the answer is yes. We did see some pre-buying, and so many of our people monitor this on a daily basis. Sales per day, units per day. I look at it per week. Carl probably looks at it per day in the case of bedding and furniture. And so we know that there were pre-buys. And what we do is when we take a look at our comps, we look at the total, and then we back out the pre-buys so that we have a better, maybe more realistic, normalized feel for that demand. But the answer is yes. And it only makes sense for the customers that have the cash ability to do that to make those pre-buys when they know that they've already gotten the announcement that 3 weeks hence there's going to be a 7.5% price increase. Their cost of capital, whatever it happens to be, is, and they do the math, and yes. So we have seen pre-buys. Yes.
A couple questions. You talked about in the fixed segment that you were ahead of plan. Does that mean that you're ahead of plan in that you know which divisions are going into core, growth, and divest?
No, I apologize for not being as clear as I should have there. We really only have one business unit that we've earmarked as fix, and it's either fix it or we're going to dispose of it, and that's our store fixtures business. That store fixtures business is a good business to be in whenever you properly execute your plan and when you have a reasonable number of SKUs that have reasonable contribution margins. So we're ahead of plan from a timing perspective in getting that return on capital employed above the 10% level. We expect that we'll be, and the 10% we use as just a guideline, our weighted average cost of capital, which is debatable, is maybe a little south of 10, but we use 10 as an example, as a threshold. And we're ahead of schedule timing-wise to get above that return level.
Can you also talk about capacity utilization in the factories now and where that's been trending and where you think see it's going?
Yeah, capacity utilization is up. I know in my briefcase over there, if I dug through it, I could get it by unit. I don't remember the percentages off the top of my head. On our conference calls, I always have that in front of me. Capacity utilization is up in bedding. Capacity utilization is up appreciably in our wire drawing facilities. Capacity utilization is always 100% at Sterling, so it's not up, it's not down. Capacity utilization is off a bit, I think, in U.S. furniture components. But in total, the capacity utilization was up, and I just don't remember the percentage. Maybe we could follow up with him and get the exact percentage. I've got it in my briefcase there, and take me a few minutes to dig it out.
Bud?
Just a quick question. As a percent of your COGS, could you give us what your raw material costs have been historically?
Yeah, it varies appreciably by operating unit, as you would expect. So in, say, our wire drying operations, it's like 80-some percent. On the other hand, in our furniture and bedding, raw materials might be 45 to 60% of the cost of goods sold.
Can you give it just on a consolidated basis?
Circa.
It's 55 to 60% company wide.
That's just what I was getting ready to say, right? I was going to say 50% or so, but yeah. Thank you, Susan.
Well, to that point, could you give what's of that percentage, can you give it, how much steel is involved with that?
I Maybe Susan can.
I don't have the breakdown now of what steel with the changes that we've made in the portfolio, but it's by far the largest raw material that we consume.
It's one that we employ a substantial amount of time when we talk about that four-letter word, LIFO. But it's a substantial piece of it. Bud?
Yeah, David, you have significant operations in China, I think 3,000 employees, and if I remember, about a dozen plants or 10 plants or so. And one of the things that China is beginning to export right now is inflation. Are we seeing any movement back onto shore? How do you characterize your operations over there? What's the capacity utilization look like over there?
You are, obviously, you're right. We have a dozen operations over there. And some of them are tied to bedding products. Those bedding products, we never produce those for export back here to this part of the world. They are consumed in China, or we do ship them to Australia, which we consider a part of Asia for our defined territory. We have operations that are engaged in furniture components for our reclining chair mechanisms, and then we also have some automotive operations, and we have a fixture and display operation over there, and we have a recent acquisition of an office furniture business over there. In mass, the things that have happened recently with the increase of raw material to a more global competitive cost, the strengthening of the RMB, the changes in the VAT, the increases in containerization, freight and logistics, have affected our Chinese operations, but in total have been a very good thing for Leggett & Platt. Our capacity utilization's down a bit in our Chinese furniture component business because of that. We're seeing a bit of a dampening in that demand. Now, our returns are very, very good, I think. Well, I know you know that, in our Chinese investments, and maybe for the rest of the group, our total investments in China or in Asia are still less than $250 million. The returns that we get from those investments are actually better than our corporate average. So what that means is we've made quite a few small, pretty intelligent bets or investments, and we will continue to do that, but wherever it makes sense. But we have seen our Chinese businesses suffer a bit, if you will, from things that the rest of the world been suffering with, in the case of currency and raw material costs and taxes.
And any incremental investment plan? I don't think Arnold is planning any additional capacity over there. He seems to be needing business now. Is that true or not?
That'd be a reasonable assessment for a furniture business, yes. Yeah, that's correct. Some of those furniture customers are looking very closely at moving to even lower cost environments such as Vietnam. And Vietnam's infrastructure is improving, just relatively speaking, and so Arnie has given considerable thought of how we would support our customers, you know, in other regions other than China, but there's no announcement to be made there. Listen, I want to thank you again for your participation. I also want to thank you for your interest in the company. Those of you that are shareholders, I thank you for your continued support. I believe that you will be very pleased with your investment in the future. Thank you very much.